There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. With me, Harriet Minter, Emma Sexton, and Natalie Campbell. This week, we're reviewing some of the top news stories that have caught our eye, speaking to Tessa Dunlop about why we should all be having children earlier, and meeting the director of new film Love, Sonia, which tackles the sex trafficking trade across the globe.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
So let's start with the news. So one story that really caught my attention today, ladies, it was in The Guardian, and it's revealed dozens of girls have been subjected to breast ironing in the UK. And it caught my attention because I did not know what breast ironing was. Have you heard of it, Emma? No.
No, I absolutely haven't.
Nat, had you?
Yes.
Yeah. So apparently it's an African practice of ironing a girl's chest with a hot stone to delay breast formation. So once or twice a week for however many months, they would take a hot stone and press down on young girls developing breasts in order to try and stop them developing. And apparently it's done to mitigate chances of sexual assault. But it's not, in this country it's abuse, it's not legal, and kind of police and community groups are estimating that around 1,000 women and girls in the UK have been subjected to it. Wow. And I was shocked. There is something going on that is regulated, expected abuse of young women that we're not even talking about. That somebody like me, who is supposed to be relatively up on these things, was completely unaware existed.
Well, so culturally, it's not something that you would know about.
Yeah.
And I think if we go back through the ages, there were lots of things done to women's anatomy to change the size. So the wrapping of feet in China and Japan.
Yeah.
Also, the boobs are wrapped to keep them small. And so it's a really difficult one because I don't want to be that Western person that swoops in and says to someone, this thing that you're doing is absolutely wrong, when in this case, they've just thought, well, how do I protect my child from being abused? Actually, let me keep her looking like a child for longer. How do I do that? Reduce her boobs, wrap them. And so if it's not the stones, then it is wrapping. It doesn't excuse it at all. But I think before we start pointing fingers, we have to understand the narrative of why. But it's also another thing of, well, let's fix the women, as opposed to doing the work to prosecute men and change the narrative around sexual abuse of young girls and young girls that are obviously just about to go through puberty. We're like, well, let's harm the girls and harm the women. It's a really difficult one for me.
I agree. I think it is really difficult. And I always feel like I come down on the side of trying to be like, we need to protect all cultures and everyone should be able to kind of do their own thing and know that we're all different and we do things in different ways and that's okay. And yet on this one, I also just feel like sometimes we can be so aware of protecting culture that we don't step in and say, actually, do you know what? No. And I understand that it is important for you. I understand where it comes from, but we're causing physical harm.
Yeah, it's physical abuse. And you can't, you know, you can have an empathy and an understanding of culturally what needs to change. But it's like FGM, you know, we can't, we ignored FGM for a long time because it's, oh, it's cultural, we won't get involved in that. And, you know, finally it's hitting kind of mainstream conversation and Nimco Ali's really been driving change there. So, you know, this is the thing where I struggle sometimes with religion and cultures is when we are perpetuating traditions that are abusive, they have to be stopped.
So, but it's not a tradition per se. Okay. It's not something that's been passed down through the ages. It's an evolution of how do I protect my daughter? I stop her going through puberty, so I'm going to iron down her breast. The bit that I was talking about in terms of it's always been done throughout history is... women's bodies have been wrapped and kept small.
Distorted.
You know, for some people, the concept of wrapping, so women that give birth in different countries in Africa, their stomachs are wrapped to help the help the womb sort of contract back. For some women, they think that, you know, that's not good. But actually in Uganda, like, it's part of the practice of looking after a woman who's just had a baby. And so... you know, it's there are
I
so many. I know.
I hear that, but that's like choose. That's your body, whereas, and that's your body. Hopefully, as a woman, as opposed to something that is being done to you against your will by someone else.
I think the solution for this, these sorts of things, it's more about it coming from within the community. So I think it's a case of education, and it's education on both sides. It's not let's fix the girls. It goes back to my point around actually it's men, it's society stepping forward. It's people protecting their daughters in a different way, not saying, well, let me just remove your breasts. It's actually who are the men either in the family or in the community that are perpetuating this behavior, prosecute them, stop them. There are elders and men. And it's for the women to take the women on a journey and educate them so they're not doing it to their own daughters. That's the way that I feel we tackle it.
And I think where we are with that is, you know, we think of that as the norm, but it's really not the norm. So I was talking to my mother over Christmas and this bizarre story came out about her mother and her mother's uncle. Everyone is now dead. I check in my head. Yes. Her mother's uncle, who was known in the family as an abuser of women. And... you know, and my mother was just like, oh, you know, Uncle Jack, I mean, he probably did something to your grandmother, but who knows? And it hadn't sort of clicked in her head that was that. And I was thinking, actually, I'm pretty certain this isn't, when we're talking recent, this is not even a generation. This is 10 years of understanding that if you've got somebody like that in your family, you don't protect them. And so we have to make that a wider conversation, definitely.
Yeah, because it's interesting, isn't it, that instead of speaking out against that person in your community, the easier choice is to...
Try and hide
and to force it, inflict this pain on a child. And, I, you know, that just shows you how difficult it must be to speak out within your community. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think you do that if you had the choice to just speak out and accuse somebody. So... yeah. Yeah, it's a complex...
Let's go back to Love, Sonia. I'm sure there are lots of people in a community that suddenly realised a child had disappeared and didn't ask the father. You know, the mothers within this, are they challenging their husbands?
Absolutely.
You know, uncles, grandfathers, are they saying, you know, where's my grandchild?
But then if you do that, but then you're disowned by your entire community, you're not going to do it. Yeah. You're just not, are you? That's the thing we forget. It's very easy for us to go, oh, no, we just have to stop it. Yeah. But actually, you know, these aren't easy choices. But they're not choices that people are making when they do this. But yeah, it does have to be stopped.
Yeah. That was the story that caught my attention first off. And we'd love to hear from you if that was new to you, did you know about it? Have you heard of this? We would love to talk to you. 0344 499 1000. The other story that I think we are all talking about, you can't have failed to miss because it's everywhere, and it is everywhere. I don't entirely understand why it's as big a deal as everyone's talking about it. Sorry, ladies, you can inform me. Facebook is merging WhatsApp and Messenger. Facebook obviously owns Facebook, which has Facebook Messenger in it. It also owns WhatsApp, which it has said all along will be a separate platform. WhatsApp encrypts everything, so nobody can kind of go in and read your messages. I don't think that's entirely the case on Facebook. I don't quite understand it. But it's going to merge the two. Everyone is up in arms about it. They're saying it's a competition issue.
Yeah.
do we care, Nat?
Yes.
Brilliant. Tell me why.
Well, so for me, WhatsApp as a messaging platform, even though I know it's on my phone and I can put something in a WhatsApp message in, and then all of a sudden Instagram starts telling me about exactly the same thing I put in my WhatsApp message. I because it is encrypted, I feel like it is one sort of social platform that is slightly private. I don't use Facebook Messenger for a reason, and that's because I don't want a large global company analysing my every single word. And also, I find Facebook quite pushy. So now I don't use it. They send me 3 or 4 emails a day saying, this person posted this and this person posted this. And there was also a point where they were trying to make me use Messenger to send a message when I was using. And I just find that behaviour, it's like a drug pusher. Yeah. And I just wonder if it's on my phone, I've lost all control. So I would rather not use it and wait for someone else to set up a separate platform than use it, if I'm being honest. And I probably shouldn't say that.
But. No, that's fine. Emma, are you going to keep using WhatsApp if they merge it with Messenger?
I think it depends. So I don't use Messenger. A lot of brands have been using Messenger because apparently you can use it on Edge, you know, when you get the E on your phone, which so you're not quite on the internet, but you're not. So.
Oh, okay. Is that what the E stands for?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When you're like, you've got very little signal, so yeah. It's like going, nearly gone.
Yeah.
E.
Yeah.
But on so the you, edge.
Yes, on the edge.
Is that true?
Apparently you can use it. So Messenger is used quite a lot at like festivals and stuff like that, because you can communicate with people when you don't have a very good signal. And brands are using it quite a lot to connect with audiences in different ways.
So you just switched me off even more now when you just said
but
that.
I think I'm with you. There are a couple of apps, actually. There's one app that's completely encrypted that some people are on already. So I think this is going to be a big problem for Facebook, because I think people will leave it. But I love WhatsApp. We've got loads of groups on there. I mean, although what I don't like is the social pressure about leaving the groups that people have added you to that you don't want to be a part of, and turning them down and then not interacting in groups. So then you're just like, you're looking at what's being posted. And then it gets to the point where you're like, well, I can't post anything now, because then I'll know that I'm watching everything they're saying, but not contributing.
But not just that, also the logging in. So with WhatsApp, you don't log in. It's just an app on your phone. If they make it so that you have to log into Facebook to use your WhatsApp, and I actively have chosen not to log into Facebook, then there's also a problem there.
Yeah. They're in trouble, Facebook. They're in trouble.
It feels quite desperate, doesn't it? It feels like a bit of a desperate move.
The Fempire Strikes Back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Welcome to the studio, talking about motherhood, and here to tell us why we should be doing it earlier rather than later, the lovely Tessa Dunlop. Tessa, thank you for joining us tonight.
Hello.
Hi.
Harriet.
Hello.
Emma and Natalie. So Tessa, you wrote an article this week saying that actually the most difficult thing for you was having your second child. Tell us a little bit about that.
I had a baby. Let's just cut to the chase. When I was 33, I had unprotected sex once and got pregnant deliberately. Okay,
great.
The man of my dreams. And out popped a baby 9 months later.
I just have to clarify, were you kind of in a relationship married with this man?
Yes, yes.
Oh, you hadn't just found him on the street like that one. Okay,
no,
good.
No.
Yeah. Okay, right.
Where did I find him originally? I can't remember. But anyway, so out popped the baby 9 months later. I thought, God, all the fuss we made. That's fine. 2 weeks after that, I then lose my job, right? So then I go into a sort of sea of panic and trauma, and my dad dies and so on and so forth. And I think at the back of my head, well, at least I know I can have a baby. Do you know what I mean? You know, didn't really sort of notice it because everything else was kicking off. Yeah. And then I got to my late 30s and I realised I was pretty jolly fond of what had become now a child. And I thought I'd just have one more, because I think we are a bit overpopulated. That's just another mistake. We'll talk about that another night. So at the ripe old age by this time of 39, because Dan and I had been, I shouldn't really use his name, he doesn't like being public. We'd had a few arguments along the way, you know, bumpity bump. Anyway, we get back on track. I'm 39. I think, well, there's loads of women now. It's all de rigueur to have a baby when you're ancient. And, you know, I thought my complexion would look quite good. Hopefully my womb would be the same. So off I went. You know what happens when you try for a baby. No need to point that out. And lo and behold, months later, because I'm quite impatient, no baby. Conception. That's a bit annoying. A couple of months later, and I'm beginning by this stage to get a sort of rising panic. Do you know what I mean? Because something that was absolutely 100% available there, age 33, suddenly at 39, no cigar. Waverley isn't hitting the station. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Okay, I seem to be having just this constant period. You know what I'm saying? I'm getting more and more stressed. People don't really sympathise with secondary infertility, so you're a little bit embarrassed about it as well. Right. It seems really indulgent and entitled. Although most people have two kids. Often it was people with three children who said, well, aren't you happy with one, weirdly enough? And childless yeah. people were really sympathetic. Whatever. And then when you're told, and I'm sure that you may, this may resonate with you or may not, you can't have something as significant as the ability to conceive and produce new life. My God, you want it. And it's weird. It's a sort of, why, if you think of having a baby in medieval times, no nappies, no hot water, you know, there is a really, we've pushed it down a bit with modernity, but there's this primal bit of us. Ultimately, we are all animals, and my inner animal, I was like the old monkey in the tree, just like wanting a mate, do you know what I mean? And I just desperately wanted a baby by now. And I was quite overtaken with how badly I wanted it. It's very undignified to be desperate, but I'm just going to smack it out there. I was desperate, okay? And I had impermissible jealousy too at the school gate. You know, all my children's friends. She was the only child in her class by one. You know, and they all skipped home with their siblings. Obviously, they probably all wanted to kill each other, those siblings. But you're not seeing that. You're just seeing that. You know, and I thought, my God, at 40-something to discover you're jealous. It's such not a good look. Okay, with the on ever-increasing. So then, and then I ended up having to do IVF and, you know, da-da-da. And I had some miscarriages and an ectopic or two because all those things happen much more with age. They're all a pain in the neck. I call it woman's pain, silent pain, because we don't really talk about it. And they're a nightmare. And the weird thing is people say it's a choice between your career and your child. The bottom line is I never stopped working because of Mara. Mm-hmm. But boy, did infertility smash out my mojo.
Right.
I felt depressed. You know, then I finally got properly pregnant with one fertilised egg. And I managed to go filming and get listeria. So I had a dead baby. It was so dark, the whole thing. And the problem is having a dead baby is really dark. But having a dead baby and not being able to get pregnant again, because that's how you kind of get rid of the sense of physical sense of loss. Mm-hmm. So it was all spectacularly dark. And actually, when you get there, and by the time you get there, arguably for some, it's too late. Mm. You don't realise how stacked the statistics are against you. And what I would say is, you know how most of us don't smoke once we get, well, to my age, I'm 44 now. Yeah. But yet most of us could point to someone in the 80s or 90s, Winston Churchill and beyond, who smokes. Yeah. Now, we don't use that as a reason to smoke. So we don't point to that guy age 90 that I'm going to carry on smoking because he's alive. But yet we go, oh, look at all those women in their 40s. They can do it. I'm just going to postpone childbirth. And the problem is as well, you don't see the thousands of women who do round after round of IVF and don't end up with a baby. Mm-hmm. You only see the ones who are winners. And you also don't realise that huge numbers in their 40s use other people's eggs. Yeah. Now, that's fine, but it's maybe not what you'd expect in your 20s when you're making a decision about when you're going to have children. So that's my story. And I've got a baby now, but it was 7 rounds of IVF. I'm just going to pump it out there. I have no car. I don't go on holiday. I am a saddo. And I'm going to be bloody old at the school gate. My dad snuffed it. My mother-in-law's too old to fly over to help. I would just say, when you're postponing babies, who's telling you that we can have babies later? Because our biological clocks, and I have this from the top gynecologist in Britain, they haven't moved a dicky bird, not since records began.
So there was like a whole load there. And I'm 35 and cooing at babies.
Have sex tonight.
Okay. So first of all, if you could help me find a man, then we can figure that one out.
Well, I'm going to find you on Instagram.
So there's that. But just so from, so 33, you could have a child. 39, you couldn't. So 39 to when? So how long was that journey?
5 years. So
5 years of looking at other people with children and just and feeling that resentment. And
yes, I'm going to be honest. The most... And I have not met a single infertile or subfertile, because I did get there in the end, but pretty damn sub, I'm telling you, it's below that line. I have not met a single one who doesn't say, my God, I can't believe it. I just don't want to go to that family reunion with all those children. Like, all of us couldn't believe how agoraphobic. You see me, I'm out there, I'm social. Honestly, I couldn't believe the impact, not just physically, but also emotionally, the range of emotions I felt about this thing that I once had. And I felt I'd been really cavalier with the ability to give my daughter a sibling, the privilege of being able to love or hate a sibling. I felt my much younger husband, I felt I couldn't give him he didn't even really want one. Both of them were like, what are you fussing about? You know, it was in my head a lot.
How old is he?
He's 8 years younger than me. Okay. So a lot of it was in my head. But most stuff is in our heads, isn't it? Yeah. You know, actually, it was fine, my life, without a second child. Yeah. But tell my, you know, I had this this, like, especially after I'd had a couple of miscarriages, this kind of ache, you know, and everything was just geared around this kind of monthly pain and failure. Now, just quickly on a few, you're 35, the age they recommend, because the things we can't, we live in modern times, we are the generation. Self-blame should go out the window, by the way. We are in a patriarch. It's amazing any of us are procreating. Do you know what I mean? But if you want to freeze your eggs, you do that now. The age they recommend, no later than 33. Right.
I don't really want to freeze my eggs, though. But
and there's controversy around how successful that is as well.
You're more likely to have a baby with a frozen egg age 33 than you are going in with your own eggs over 40.
See, the challenge is, though, Tessa, your story, which is great that you're sharing. I think the challenge I have with your story is that you talk about decision of having kids.
Yeah.
And I feel like the majority of women are not in the position to decide. Natalie wants kids. She's not in a position to decide that because she's not in a relationship. So then what does she do?
And I think it's almost putting the fear of God in me without options of what.
Okay, well, I would say freeze your. I'm just going to be like, you've got a job. You look employable. You look like you could do without a summer holiday.
Do you think I'm employable?
Well, you're employed.
I could do without a holiday.
Yeah, well,
no.
That's the
money.
Cost of freezing your eggs.
Right. How much does it cost?
Right, a round of IVF. This is the other thing. There's so much. This is a good
include
word.
The emotional bit too.
Oh, that's huge.
Because I've got like five jobs, so I need to.
Oh, don't worry.
Function.
No, you can do all that. I meant the emotional thing. If you can't have children, it's huge.
Right.
Oh,
okay.
You'll be buoyed up.
Okay.
The fertility drugs make you feel quite good. Briefly, you think you're going to give birth to the whole of a continent. I mean, you know, your ovaries are so stimulated. It's ridiculous. What was I going to say? Something really
freezing
profound.
Eggs.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't.
We're talking about decisions.
Decisions. So that is an option that is now available. Mm. You know, it's not foolproof. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the two things that IVF rates have hugely improved for problems that aren't age related. Mm-hmm. OK, the two things that are age related are the number of eggs you have that decreases and it rapidly starts decreasing from the age of 35 onwards. I'm sorry, this is biology. Mm-hmm. I can't undo it. OK, the other thing are the quality of those eggs. They cannot improve the quality. So with me, an old goat, they dragged out every time more and more drugs. Any egg, they were just literally raking through the tragic number of eggs I had until we hit jackpot. And I stopped doing the IVF. It was a frozen embryo. And it was, I mean, I'm just telling you, you don't want to end up there. So I would say freeze a round of eggs because it'll take the heat off finding a partner. You don't want to end up with the wrong one. It's like having cash in the bank. You know, if you put in an ISA, you know, with Trump's manoeuvres and Brexit, your ISA may be worth nothing tomorrow. But it's nice to know you've got an ISA. I liquidated mine for IVF. It's the same with eggs in that nothing's guaranteed. You know, I can't guarantee we'll all be alive tomorrow. But you do, it's something it's an insurance policy. It's going to cost you $4,000. Three grand, four grand. I can't remember.
I completely hear what you're saying, but I don't actually know that women are being given a message that they can wait.
Because
I'm 30, now we're doing age, I'm 37, and I feel like I've had that message since about 28.
I feel like I'm putting on.
Don't be cynical, not at all. I feel like all the messages around me. I mean, I wrote an article when I was, I think, 32, saying that I felt like at some point I'd had to accept that I was probably heading for the point where I was now too old to have kids.
Right.
And my dad, bless him, sent me an email saying, "Oh, darling, I thought you'd chosen your career over kids 8 years ago. Just as well you did. It's a much better investment."
Is he listening now? Hi, Dad.
Hi, Dad. I was like, I didn't realise that I had made that choice, but the whole world around me had gone, you're too old now.
No,
and
you're not
I
too
was
old.
Really getting that message.
That's interesting because I think there's huge numbers of people, you know, who you see in their 40s, lots of celebrities. Mm. They're never quite candid about actually how difficult it was to get pregnant.
I remember reading a great book where they had lots of, it was a fictional book, but I'm never entirely sure how fictional it was, where they got very good looking people to go to an island and basically fertilise their eggs and then put them in celebrities. And I thought, I'm pretty certain that is what is
there
happening.
There you are. I'm sorry. But, of course it is, but they're not. Yeah.
Women can't win, right? Because we're told
that
if you're going to make a decision, you can't have kids when you're older. I remember being in my 20s and I remember being at school and the women who got pregnant early, they were really like, it was not a cool thing to get pregnant in your early 20s.
Yeah,
your
agree.
Life isn't even taken off. I now, obviously through social media, I'm connected to some of those people I went to school with who had kids aged 22, 23. Yeah. They are now 42 and their kids are now at uni. And they are having the time of their lives. And I was like, you ladies, you have it nailed.
We have, we've been served an absolute googly. I remember my mum standing on the landing in the 70s going, the world's your oyster, darling, for God's sake, don't have babies young.
Yeah.
You can imagine how much I want to when actually when I couldn't have a child. No, I was like, it's all right. I didn't mean that, by the way.
If you
really
have babies in your 20s, your body is designed to have that baby. Also, you have no, we're all told you don't have kids in your 20s because of your career. My career was stagnant in my 20s, really. I was
taking
out, I was
now,
going into work hungover. Like, I progressed up the career ladder slightly. But having kids in my 20s, because it's in your 30s where you really have an impact on your career. So I feel like we've just been sold this, like,
but then think about who you were sleeping with in your 20s. Would you really have wanted to have kids with them?
Oh, that's called bringing it down, isn't it, Harriet?
I mean, the sperm would have been fresher, Harriet.
To be honest, I lost my virginity very late. But just quickly, but we live in a patriarchy. Remember, we have women have entered a work structure designed by men, for men. And that is what needs challenged. So I'm coming here, I'm not really lecturing you. I was writing for the Mail. There were set parameters.
Okay, tell them, we know.
I think we need to do far more to protect women in their the 10-year window when I think they're best equipped emotionally and biologically to have babies, which is sort of 24 to 34. And we don't look after them. Look, I was sacked 2 weeks after I gave birth.
Can you just add another year, like two, to
35.
That?
35.
Just take it to 36.
Do you know, you're going to be
one
cool,
more.
Babe.
Just
I'm going to come in here next time and wet nurse your baby for you because you'll be too busy
Tessa
working.
Is sliding into your DMs later with lots of potential baby daddies. It's okay. Tessa Della, thank
them.
You so
can
much.
Do Tinder.
Thank you so much for coming in and joining us. If people want to chat to you about this and get your experience, where can they find you?
Oh, you can Twitter me, actually, because I really feel women need to support each other more, too. Yeah. I mean, whether you want babies or not, I'm saying you have to have a baby, for God's sake. There's enough on the planet, but we need to support each other more. Tessa Dunlop, I think it's my handle is Tessa Dunlop. I need to go and check that out.
We'll find it out. We'll tweet her so you know.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is Plush Care. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Now, our next guest has directed a movie that I watched this morning and I'm still reeling from. It was so powerful. Tabrez Narani, thank you so much for joining us, director of Love, Sonia. The film is set in India, in Mumbai. It tells the story of a girl being sold from her village into the sex trade in Mumbai and what then happens to her and how that sex trade is not an Indian problem, it is a worldwide global problem. It is an incredibly moving film, but watching it I was found it very dark and very affecting. What was it like to direct that?
It's been a long journey for me because literally this started 14 years ago when I first encountered a girl who was trafficked, you know, a girl from the East who was found in LA in a container. Who was this girl? What was she doing there? What sense does it make to have an Indian girl show up in LA? How does this happen? And that was my introduction to the world of global human trafficking, global sex trafficking. And initially, it was research that kind of prompted me to talk to the NGOs, meet them, try to find out, you know, how this happens. And it literally was pure research. But then I got sucked into it, and the next thing you know, I was, you know, 3-4 years later, I was on raids in brothels in Mumbai, rescuing girls. And over a period of 10-12 years, based on all the girls that we met, rescued, and went through rehab with, came the story of Love, Sonia. So it's been a long journey, and a very difficult movie to make, because no one wants to make a movie about sex trafficking, especially then in Hindi.
Yeah.
And at that point, with no names.
Yeah.
So I'm just happy that it's out in cinemas now.
Well, it's released nationwide in the UK now, but you said it's also been released previously in India. What was the response to that?
So it was interesting, because normally a movie like this would not get released in India at all. So I think it was interesting that we actually were able to get a release, and that's great. I fought the censor board so that what we see in the UK is pretty much what we saw in India. That took a year. We released in 350 screens, which is the equivalent of us releasing the way that Spider-Man does. Mm. It's massive. So I think that was an accomplishment.
Yeah.
But the movie didn't do well. India, I don't think, is ready for a film like that. Because remember that you still have majority of the population living way below the poverty line. They want to go to be entertained.
What made you do this as a feature film rather than, say, a documentary? Because as Harriet said, it is a very deep, dark but important topic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think most people go to the movies for entertainment.
Yeah.
What made you decide to do it in that way?
Once you've met these girls, especially once you've seen a girl who comes out the other side, the first girl I rescued was like 12 years old, and she'd been there for 4 years.
Wow.
But once you rescue them, or once they go through rehab, and a few of them, they stand tall and they are rock stars. You feel such shame. And after meeting so many of them and seeing what they go through, I think documentaries are great for certain subjects, and they've been great documentaries done on sex trafficking. But obviously with a movie, and if you're able to populate it with a few interesting actors and engage people, I think the audience is wider.
Mm. And so can you give us a sense of the journey that some of these girls go on, and also reflecting the story? Because actually the journey is... I don't want to give too much away, but she's ultimately looking for her sister.
Correct,
and is
yeah.
trafficked herself and ends up in LA.
Yeah.
So is that generally what happens, or do a lot of girls stay within India, within brothels?
Oh, no, absolutely.
Brothels?
I mean, they stay... we've seen the stories. We've seen UK, Moldova.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Nepal, Mumbai.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Mexico, LA.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just, we have obviously lots of domestic trafficking in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
Is there global human trafficking? Absolutely. Global sex trafficking, a massive market. It's just that we haven't seen it. It's okay if it happens in
India.
That
hurts my heart that you just said global sex trafficking, a massive market.
Yeah,
because for some people it is... a market.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just a way of making money.
It is the most number one most profitable black market business in the world. The ILO now estimates $150 billion in profits. But to answer your question, the whole idea was, it's okay if it happens in India, it's okay if it happens in China, but suddenly if you bring it back to LA or to the UK, then
that's
things
when,
change.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the point of it, to make people realize that it happens just right under our noses.
I have to be honest, the bit in the movie that shocked me the most, and it's towards, you know, the sort of latter third of it, and there had been a lot of shocking stuff up until that point, and is the bit where you see her being raped by a white man. And it wasn't until that point that I had realized that I hadn't sort of seen, because it had all been said in India, I hadn't seen that, and I hadn't really been taking it in. And then suddenly it just brought it so home to me that this is not a problem that is happening on the other side of the world. This is a problem that is happening in towns up and down the UK.
Absolutely. And I think that really is what we are finding, regardless of where we screen, that it makes people... It starts a conversation, which is great, And you know, I'm hoping that people will go to the cinema to be engaged. And at some point after the first 10 minutes, they, you know, they invested in the sisters. But when they walk out, hopefully only one thing is on their mind.
And what can I do about it?
Exactly.
And what can you do about it? Because that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, you know, okay, this is great. It's raising awareness.
Yeah.
Wow, there's this like phenomenal underground black market that's going on. How many girls have I passed just walking to the studio tonight that may have been
that's
or
right.
maybe being trafficked and held against their will? What can I do? What?
So I think that, you know, everyone can do something. There's obviously various levels. There's various ways to combat sex trafficking. Education, awareness, raising the poverty level. I think that whether it's helping your local NGO or the NGOs associated with the film, we had young high school students who went back to school the next day and wanted to start their own small NGO. But what's amazing is it's about awareness. You know, in Asia, let educate not only your daughters, but educate the sons. It's the boys that need education.
Oh, because in the documentary as well, and in the trailer, you have the stat: there's 270 women
That's
and girls
right, yeah.
every day that are lost to this system. Is it affecting young boys and men in
yes.
the same way?
So even though 98% of sex trafficking victims are women, because the numbers are so massive, we forget that it happens to young boys,
yeah.
to men. And surprisingly enough, I was reading an article yesterday that out of 2,500 calls that came in 2016 to one of the local UK NGOs, 1,500 were male clients.
Wow.
And that was interesting.
And this is ultimately because, as you said, it's a market. And, you know, I agree with you. We need to educate boys. We need to call on the NGOs. But ultimately, banks, in the same way they can test for money laundering, they know where this money's moving. The shipping companies, someone is allowing these containers
yeah.
to be put on ships. And so it really is. It's this thing of, does everyone know? And they're just turning a blind eye because money's moving and no one wants
yeah,
to take this money out of the system.
I think there's definitely an element of that. But the good thing is, I feel like every year there is progress. So, for example, just in the past 2 years in LA, with now there's an LAPD sex trafficking task force.
Right.
And with the NGOs that I work with, I'm actually on the board of one of the NGOs that's in the movie. They, over a period of 1 year, did employee training for every single hired employee. Because think about where most of the trafficking is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have hotel employees, you have airline
yeah.
employees
yeah.
who are trained to be aware. And the truth is, there so many of sex trafficking rings are busted by us,
yeah.
by regular people.
Mm.
So I think things are changing. Yes, unfortunately, they aren't changing quick enough.
Mm.
And the money is the biggest problem. And the prosecution of the end user and the trafficker. Because if there aren't enough prosecutions, this is going to continue to happen.
You've got some big stars in this movie. Was it difficult to get them on board with such a really difficult subject?
So in India, initially it was, but after they read the script and they met me and they realized that, you know, the biggest thing was, which I know that everyone, I'm sure even you when you started to watch the movie, was how to not exploit the exploited, to make sure that you navigate that line because you can't, you can't go over it. So it was difficult, but we were able to get a really good cast together. Demi has her own NGO.
It's Demi Moore?
Yes, Demi
yeah.
Moore. And her NGO that she started years ago, it fights child pornography using technology. And we've been on the same forums before, so she was happy to help. And Mark Duplass as well. They just, you know, they wanted to help throw light on the subject.
Amazing.
Where do you want to go with this now? Do you want to keep making films in this area? Is this the film that you make that launches your director career, I guess, or is this the film that you make that launches you as the kind of
as an activist?
I think
where do you think it goes?
That's going to remain forever,
yeah.
Because you know I'm on the board of CAST, which is the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking, and regardless of the movies that I do, I will always be involved. my upcoming projects, a lot of them are socially conscious and female driven, and a lot of them are what you wouldn't expect that I would do, because the truth is I'm a filmmaker, but I want to make sure that I'm true regardless of the story and it's authentic. But this is something that I will be doing hopefully for the rest of my life in terms of raising awareness and working with the girls and helping them.
I'm just having a little moment because I am getting a bit teary because I watched the film, and when I watched the film, I'm going to be really honest, I was really angry with men.
Yeah.
I was really angry at the male abuse from the very beginning to almost to the end of this film, and I left really feeling like,
because the thing we didn't say, it's actually her father.
Yeah,
it's her father that puts her into the system.
Yeah, yes. And Jarvis, I just want to say thank you for coming in and like mildly restoring my faith. But it is—it's really important that it is men like you that stand up and say, "Actually, this is not okay. This, I will go into those brothels, I will rescue those girls, and then I will tell the world about it." Mm. And that's what makes the difference, and I just want to encourage more men to do that. Yes.
So I was actually going to say, I think that the narrative will be picked up in a different way because you are a man directing this movie, and that you have been on a journey to do this over the last 14 years, as opposed to seeing something a year ago and then making a movie about it. So I think it does it gives the story a completely different form, and people listen in a different way. And it shouldn't be the case. Anyone who speaks out about this should be listened to.
Yeah.
But actually, I think people will take the message on board because you're a man standing
up. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah.
I hope so. Wow. Tabrez, thank you so much for joining us. Tabrez Noorani, director of Love, Sonia. It is out nationwide now. It is an incredible movie. I really urge you to go and see it and just learn from it. It's brilliant, brilliant movie. 1, 2, 3, 4! This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.